And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Linda Lloyd, and my guest today is Robert Hicks, the best-selling author of The Widow of the South and A Separate Country. Robert is here to talk about his latest book, The Orphan Mother, published by Grand Central Publishing. Robert introduces us to Mariah Reddick, widow, former slave, midwife, and mother of Theopolis. After her son's murder, Mariah is determined to seek justice for a child who had hoped someday the world could get better, for Negroes especially, but maybe even for whites, too. Robert, welcome to Book Talk.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Mariah Reddick, the subject of this new book, The Orphan Mother, is the former slave of Carrie McGavick, who is actually the Widow of the South.
Yes.
Does this book... Is it like a sequel to The Widow of the South, or do they play together?
You know, that's funny that you ask that. It's a good question, because I really never envisioned it as a sequel, but of course they do. I mean, what was I thinking? When I finished The Widow of the South in the author notes, and again, not having any idea that 11 years later I would be fulfilling that, but I said that I thought that Mariah was the most interesting character because in a great way she was a mystery to me. And so I wanted to pursue her in my mind at some point, I thought, yeah. Well, I started pursuing her and she became just exactly what I thought, the most interesting character. So yes, it is a sequel. I mean, and now she has this issue among her many issues, and that is to separate herself from her former owner. This is, I think, a problem that enslaved people had often. If they had terrible owners, then they could just walk away. But what do you do if the person that formerly was your kind of a, not just owner, but kind of in their minds, protector, what do you do to completely say, I have to be my own person. You can't be in this role anymore. You can't. I'm not a child. It's more than just being, I was enslaved. It's like, I am not yours to help. And so that's one of the big issues. So yes, in that sense, it is a sequel.
And you're writing this from Mariah's perspective. How do you write in a black woman's voice and also... when she loses her only child, how do you know what that's like?
That is probably not just a good question, but that's the question. When I went on book tour with The Widow of the South, I went on what was in Warner Books. They've changed their name to Grand Central, but I went on their longest book tour in history. And by the time I got to like 95% of the places, the people had actually read the book and they wanted to come, especially women, because I had dealt with a woman and they wanted to ask me questions. The question that they almost inevitably always asked was not how you got it wrong as far as when Carrie loses her children, but how do you understand what we have gone through for women who had lost children? And the only answer I ever had, and it's the only answer I really have for you, is I didn't channel my feminine side. I didn't, bring in women friends. I simply tried to understand what it is like to be a human. One of my favorite songwriters in Nashville is a woman named Beth Nielsen Chapman. And several years ago, when her husband was dying of cancer, she wrote a whole series of songs, and I think some of her best. And in one song, she says, and it sounds flippant right now, but she said, we all suffer some loss. Except it was really profound for her. She was talking about the death of Ernest, this incredible man she'd been married to. And I think that that's what I channel, is the fact that as humans, loss is loss. Now, I'm not saying that women don't have a particular loss or that women of color don't have a particular loss. But in the long run, that's all I can draw from is the fact of my humanity. That's what I'm trying to draw from. So that's really the answer.
Mariah and Carrie share that loss of children. But you made a very good point. Women who lose children don't have a name. Is that what... You said, women who lose husbands are widows. Children who lose parents are orphans. But women who lose their children really don't have any designation. Is that what the orphan mother means?
That's exactly what it is. I mean, I think that, and we all have known women who bury a child before they can be buried. And there is a profound, especially if it's an only child, there is a profound loss that they bear, really, I think, to the grave. I mean, at least the ones I have known. A few years ago, Rodney Crowell, who's a singer-songwriter in Nashville, an old friend of mine, asked me, we were in a line in a buffet at a party, and he said, "Are you an orphan too?" And I stood there and wanted to say no. But the reality is I buried both my parents when I was a young person. My father when I was 22 and my mother when I was 33, which are seeming really young right now. I finally had to say to someone, "I am an orphan." And it led me to a real profound thought process that orphans are different from the way I had envisioned them as, you know, a child somewhere in some institution, mm-hmm. that I was an orphan and that others can be orphans too. And I then went back in my mind to women I had known, especially as a child, who were profoundly altered by the death of a child. Some people just could never get over it. I remember some people, the Coins in North Carolina, and just at the mention of the death of the child, both Raymond Coins and his wife, who was an outsider artist, would just burst into tears, you know, 40 years afterwards. So there is somewhat of a reality to being an orphan, even when you're not, like, you know, a child.
Mm-hmm. And Mariah is orphaned in that she has lost her only child and lost him not in a way that would be an easy way to accept. She says that his murder is almost like slaughtering winter hogs. Yeah. And that just, you know, stuck with me.
I wanted to envision how this woman, who is a midwife, who has brought into life so many of the people in Franklin, black and white, would respond to losing her only son. And to tell you the truth, I wanted it to be a powerful loss. I wanted it to be the kind of loss that one normally would never get over, you know, if you can ever get over anything. And so that's really why. So that's kind of how that all came about.
Did you research murders that had occurred like that during emancipation or after that time?
You know,
or was that just all part of...
The two things I had to really research on this book were Reconstruction and midwifery. I don't think I want to know anything more about either one of them. I mean, you know, you women, you don't even remember what all you went through to have a child. I mean, I'll ask women at times about different aspects, and they'll go, "No, I don't remember that." So it's a mess. The same thing with Reconstruction. It's so different than what I was told as a child. First of all, there isn't Reconstruction right after the Civil War. It doesn't start for about 2 years. I mean, there's this limbo period where the Union Army's still here because, you know, they just won and they were here fighting. And so they're here and they're kind of trying to keep everything sorted out and be some kind of authority, but they really don't have authority other than just by force. Then secondly, Andrew Johnson becomes a huge complication because he's the president. And even though Nashville was, I think, you know, what, put up a statue to him about 120 years after the fact, because they still were, you know, bitter about it, he actually kept Tennessee and oddly enough, most of Virginia out of Reconstruction as long as he could. So if you talk about Reconstruction, it was very different in Tennessee than it was, let's say, in Georgia or Mississippi or Texas. It was a very different kind of system. So I did spend a lot of time researching this. And what's happening, there's a lot of lawless murdering going on as whites are trying to regain power It's one reason I think Reconstruction really almost had to come about, because they had to start dealing with it. You know, I think that one of the issues that is becoming more and more a point is whether any of us can write about something we're not. You know, I think at one point this was just taken for granted that we could, and now there's this whole movement that says we don't have the right, that somehow we are confiscating someone else's culture or heritage by writing about them. And I guess my question would be, is it seems like isn't the test as to whether it is true to the person you're writing about, whether you're writing about a woman who is losing children in childbirth, or whether you're writing about, you know, in this case, a woman of color who is trying to survive this crazy racist world that she has been put into. And to me, I think the only answer is does it ring true? If it doesn't ring true, then it should be rejected. But the idea of you know, maybe saying, well, this is not fair, you shouldn't be able to write about it. If we reversed it and if we said to a woman of color, you're not allowed to write about a white man, I think all of us would scream racism right away. So I that's where I'm caught. I have a lot of empathy, and I don't mean that flippantly. I grew up in a world that I've always borne a lot of empathetic feelings for others. And so I think that that has something to do with how I write. I try to get the details of a childbirth or of a child's death right. But as far as the feelings, I just think that I try to channel what it's like to be a human and to lose.
Well, you talked about how you had to learn about midwifing as well as the Reconstruction. And those really play into this together, because Elijah Dixon is one of the key players in the death of Mariah's son. And she's the midwife who actually saves his youngest child.
Right.
I mean, did he think about Mariah's son when he decides to put all of this riot into play to make sure he gets what he wants?
I think Elijah Dixon represents those men of power, often, in his case for sure, white men of power, but any men of power who simply don't think about what they're doing as to having any real effects on others. A sociopath cannot be empathetic. I mean, that's just, I've been told that again and again by people in the field. But they can be sentimental. You know, they can, you know, Hitler loved small children and dogs, we're told. But to let happen these things, you can't be empathetic. That's the only reason that you know, the sociopath can, you know, kill the child or kill an animal or whatever it is because they don't have that within them. And so Elijah Dixon, I think, represents simply people who grasp power at anyone's cost. And so, no, the fact that his newest child has been saved by this woman while he puts into place the murder of her son, really, I don't think he makes that connection. It's unbelievable to me, even having written it. But I think there are people in the world that's very much true.
There's some very interesting characters, and one of those is particularly George Toll, who is the assassin that Elijah Dixon hires, not to kill Mariah's son, but to kill one of his enemies.
Right.
But he's also an artist.
Yeah, he's a bad person in many ways. He's a killer. And yet, he's someone that's almost gotten caught up in it all, who has this desire to be someone else, to not be a killer. That's his goal when he arrives in Franklin, is he doesn't want to kill people anymore. And yet, you know, this incredibly flawed man still, like, does what is easiest to do.
Through that, he sets into motion a whole different chain of events.
And tries to rectify it in a very real way. here he is. He's a functionary. He does what he's been trained to do. But when he sees people doing evil, he feels like he can somehow, in some twisted way, and it's twisted to Mariah's point of view, in some twisted way, he can somehow rectify all the evil things he does in this world.
Their situations are very different. George Toll, as he prefers to be called,
right,
has grown up as a freed man. He grew up in the North. He's always been free. And Mariah is a former slave. So did you want those two contrasts?
I did,
between
absolutely.
The two?
You're absolutely right, because I wanted to show that there's this vast complication of, you know, you can't just stereotype people. So here is this man who really has known nothing of slavery. You know, he's obviously known racism. He's known, you know, many doors closed to him because he is a black man, but nothing like what she's experienced through her life. And so I wanted to be sure that there was some depth to this whole world that I was creating for them. He wants to start his life over. It's not like he really wants to make good his past. He just simply wants to start over. So he comes here to the South where things are changing, and he thinks he can make a new life for himself. And all of a sudden, he's surrounded by fellow African-Americans who are, you know, newly made freed men and freed women. And he's trying to learn how to deal with them.
And initially, when he meets Mariah, he sees her as a very strong woman.
Absolutely.
But then one of her good friends says, no, she's really not. She still thinks of herself as a slave. Do you think Mariah still saw herself? I know she described herself when she's talking to the people from the university as the bottom rail.
I think so. I mean, I think she's smart enough to know that, you know, she is at the bottom of it all. But she will become her own person. And I mean, and she does it through loss. I mean, she does it through surviving the loss of her son, the loss of someone she loves, all sorts of loss. And yet it takes her a long time. What she's doing with Carrie on the day of the tribunal is really one of her two goals. Her macro goal is to be heard. You know, in a time when women, let alone women of color, would have a very hard time being heard before a military tribunal, she wants to be heard. In a micro vision, she wants to free herself from Carrie. She wants to be able to have a relationship with Carrie where Carrie is not simply trying to take care of her. Even that is demoralizing to her.
I know that it was important for her in that tribunal as they're trying to figure out what happened to cause not only a black man to be killed, but there was a white man killed.
Absolutely.
During all of this confusion and everything going on. But she made a very important point, and that was that she had to take her seat so that the seat would not disappear.
She is also foretelling that the world will never be the same. It may have setbacks, and of course, heaven knows it continues to have setbacks, but that the world will never be the same. They are going to move forward. I had a great friend who I dedicated the book to named Tom Murdoch, and he was a great guy in Franklin and an amazing person. And he was a man of color, and he's my age. And so that means that he was cognizant. He was in his maybe the earliest of his teens when he could actually sit on the main floor of the local theater and didn't have to sit in the colored balcony, or he could go to Willow Plunge. We had the largest freshwater pool in the Southeast United States. And he couldn't go there. Or he could go, you know, wherever. He survived all that. And I asked him one time, how did you handle that? I mean, I don't think I could have. And he said, my grandmother always told us that it would get better. And we believed her. And he said, that's the strength of having a matriarchal society. A lot of bad things come with it, but that was a good thing. We listened to her. Now, I don't know that that would be enough, that simply someone in authority told me it's going to get better someday. But I think that a lot of what I was writing there is about the fact that she knows that they will not be able to go backwards forever, that they will be able to push forward. And it did happen, and it is happening, and hopefully it will continue to happen.
I know that at one point she refers to the thing that she feels like is being kept from her people, and that is knowledge. Do you think that's still the same today, that people in power, no matter what, you know, situation is, that it's all about knowledge?
Absolutely. I think so much of it, I don't know if it's all about knowledge, but so much of what we struggle with is that people in power, let's say, so we won't focus on us completely, but let's say in Marxist countries, that people in power want you to have information but not have too much information. Because if you have too much information, it'll change the world.
And the information needs to come from them.
Right. And which means it's often not true information.
And that seems to be what is happening in the book as far as Elijah Dixon trying to control, even during the tribunal, when people are talking, he still wants to control how that information is being let out.
Absolutely. And she is there, as she says, even before she goes there, she is there to point the finger. And that's what she's saying about the chair. You know, that's what she's saying about her role there. She has to say what she needs to say so that it can't go backwards. She prepares it. There'll be setbacks. But that, again, this is part of what my friend Tom Murdoch, 100 years later, was slowly moving toward. It was getting better.
In their world, it took a long time to get there. But she wanted to get justice. And she said, in the long term, forgive whoever killed her son. That was sort of her end.
Absolutely.
She really felt very strongly about
that. She wanted to know. She wanted to know why a really good man like her son was murdered. She wanted to know who did it. But ultimately, you know, she has an amazing sense of forgiveness because she's willing to go on with her life, but she does want to know first.
And at the beginning and of the book and at the end, we see Mariah as an old, old woman,
right,
almost on her deathbed. And she's making a bequest to a black university, but she wants no recognition for it. Why is it so important for her other kids get educated?
Well, because, again, that is the way that they can move into the future. That is what her son wanted and was denied in so many ways. And she wants to move him and all the people after him into a better future, a brighter future.
One of the things that bothered me at the end was how you included the obituary about Mariah and the fact that they had to say in the newspaper that she had very little Negro blood but was half Indian and French, giving her clear mentality and a combination of characteristics marked and unusual. Why? I mean, why did they even have to say that?
Because, of course, that's part of, like, putting that finger down on people. I mean, that's just innate racism. And, it, you know, that's what the university people are saying to her. You don't want people to know who gave this money. You'll just be known as some old broken-down negress. And if they even have an obituary. Because they had to be able to say that this extraordinary person had a reason that she was extraordinary. So we'll say, oh, it's because she has white blood or our Native American blood.
Not that she birthed everybody in this county.
Yeah, not that she was this incredibly decent human being. There must be some reason. It's the same way that mixed blood enslaved people were more valuable than people that were straight from Africa, because somehow it was thought, and this is hideous, but it was thought that they were more intelligent. It was thought that they were more trustworthy. You could make them into house servants because they had white blood in them. And so she's coming along at that very time when that's how people envisioned it.
And even though she has done so much for so many, it doesn't matter. At her death, we still have to come up with a reason why.
Absolutely.
This, yeah, okay.
And I grew up in that world. I mean, I'm a little older than you. So I grew up in that world where, yeah, you had to explain why an African-American could be so talented or so intelligent. It's an absurd craziness to all that stuff.
How did you decide to write about this particular era? I mean, the widow is there.
Right.
The orphan mother is there.
What happened is I was kind of the driving force behind this house museum where both Carrie and Mariah lived at different times in their life called Carnton Plantation. I had challenged our board. I was then, ironically, I'm about to go off the board in December. But at the time, I was the youngest board member there. And they were going nowhere. And it was just at a standstill. And so I challenged the board. I said, I'll go out and raise the money. And I like that idea.
Always.
If you all will give up the right to make aesthetic choices. And they begrudgingly let me do this, even though they didn't really think I could. They liked the idea of me raising the money, but they later told me they never really believed it would happen. So I had to learn about the house. It was more than just bringing in historians on wallpaper or a furniture plan or the garden. It was learning myself why people did certain things. And so I got so entangled in this mid-19th century world. And then in the middle of it, this horrendous 5 hours of a battle. And we got finished doing this decorating project. It took us years, restoration, and nobody came still. And so I sat in my office in Nashville at Polygram Music, and I thought, how do I get people there? And I come from a long line of delusional people. And I thought, you know what? I could write a novel, and I would get like one of the top agents in the country, and it would become a New York Times bestseller and an international bestseller, and people would come. And the irony in all this is that all that happened. I did cold call an agent, and I was able to scribble a book together, and it became a New York Times bestseller, an international bestseller, and people came. That's the key part. I've gotten to live. There were 7,000 people that came to Carnton the year that The Widow of the South came out. A lot of them after September 1st when it came out. Last year, we had over 125,000.
Wow.
So it is happening. And I don't think there's any reason why we couldn't have 250,000 people coming to Franklin to see it. So that's really why. I guess if it had been about, if I lived on a ranch in Hawaii, it could have been about the, you know, the internment of people or, you know, out there or something. But that's not where I live. So this is what I wanted to write about.
Well, it's interesting that a germ of an idea like that, where you're trying to fundraise, would actually lead to
I think
books.
It's pretty unique. Now, what it does is, it does mean when I go on book tours that people come up to me and go, we have this house museum and we're not going anywhere and it's got a really great story. Would you mind writing a novel about it? And I'm like, maybe not.
So what is your next novel about?
I have no
idea. Are we
going to
stay in the same period?
I don't know. I have no idea. I feel very complete in these three books. I'm not sure. I would like to write contemporary fiction someday, number one. And number two, I'd really like to get involved in film. And I'm writing a screenplay right now that has nothing to do with any of the three books.
And is that going well for you?
It is going very well. Now, I don't know if it'll ever see the light of the projector, but as far as it goes, it's going very well. I'm really enjoying it. You know, it's been just a real pleasure to work with it.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what disillusioned or illusioned?
Oh, that I come from?
Mm-hmm.
Delusional.
Delusional.
Yeah,
okay.
I come from, I mean, you know, but it somehow it is, has paid off over the years. Not just me, but I mean, I can say generations of people in my family have thought they could do things, and it turned out they could. And I think a lot of times, just that passion and belief that you can do, it can't guarantee you anything. But without it, it's going to be hard to do it too, you know. So I think that it does happen. But yeah, I now the problem with this is that as I said, I went out on Warner Books' longest book tour, and I became like the patron saint of delusional people, and they would come and they would want to tell me about their novel, and every once in a while, in fact, I got some to my agent. It's one of those people. I got them to my agent, and he actually got a few of them published. But I would sit there and I would listen to just amazingly bad stories, and I want to go, God, you need to bury this so deep that no one will ever be able to dig it up. But you know, you can't say that to someone. And I would have been devastated when I was writing The Wood of the South if someone had said that to me. But I do get to meet a lot of people who have heard the story of how I was able to, you know, get a book published. I one guy walked up to me one night, and people don't realize what they say, and he said, "Gosh, Mr. Hicks, I'd love you to hook me up with your agent." And I said, "I don't mind. I'll do it. I can't tell you he'll love the book, whatever it is." He goes, "Well, I want you to read it." And I go, I can't read it.
Right.
I'm not an agent. I'm not a publisher. I'm not an editor. I write my books, but that doesn't mean some people are all those things, but it's not me. But I said, "I don't mind." And he said, "No, I have to tell you this, Mr. Hicks. If he liked your books, he will love mine. This book is so much better. I mean, on every level, his storyline, writing, everything." And I just said, "Great, I'll get it to him." And I did. And a few days later, my agent called me up and he goes, "You will not believe what this guy said to me." I went, "Oh yeah, I will."
He said it to me.
He goes, "No, he could not. He was tell." I said, "No, tell me, Jeff. I he told me, you know, yes. I mean, it's a much better book." He goes, It's not even like publishable by any level." And so, but it could have been. And I didn't want to be the one who stopped the great American novel from being published just because this guy believed in it.
And you really don't know what the great American novel is going to be, because that changes, I think, based on what tastes are. But fortunately, in The Orphan Mother, we have some interesting characters who have worked very well.
Listen, thank you so much. I hope so. I thought you were going to say, "Fortunately, we finally have the great American novel in The Orphan Mother," but that's all right. I'll take this. And I'll maybe let Moby Dick and all the King's Men try to keep their position, you know, as the great American novels. But, you know, I love this book.
It's a good book.
I'm being honest. I love the characters. I hope I've been true to them. As I said, that's going to be ultimately the decision. I hope people will give it a chance and read it and see if they are true. And, you know, it was the hardest thing I ever wrote. And in so many ways, I believe it's to be the best.
Well, I just appreciate you taking the time to come by and talk with us today about it.
Well, it's my pleasure. I love Memphis. I've loved this town all my life. Spectacular library y'all have here. And you have so much to be proud of in this town.
Well, thank you. And I hope that we'll get to see you again soon.
I hope so.
We've reached the end of our time for Book Talk today. I want to say thank you to our guest, Robert Hicks, the author of The Orphan Mother, published by Grand Central Publishing. I'm Linda Lloyd, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.